The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It is Monday, December the 12th, 2011, and this is Richard Martin with your wake-up call coming to you live from Singapore through New York City and Progressive Radio Network. Well, I suppose I'd better say a word or three about the so-called European Summit. As you probably heard, the Eurozone leaders emerged at 5 a.m. on Friday morning from an all-night meeting and announced a plan to restructure the Eurozone. What better way to begin a show than to get the words of Nigel Farage that I have put on the show several times in the past. He is a member of the European Parliament for Britain. And he has a particularly pithy way of describing himself, as I'm sure those of you who've listened to the wake-up calls where Nigel has been on the air will attest. So I thought it would be somewhat appropriate to listen to what he has to say, this time not in session at the European Parliament, but in an interview. He was asked for his views about these things. And so, without further ado, let's go to Nigel Farage being interviewed on the TV.
Well, let's talk to an MEP who's following all this with a keen eye, the UK Independence Party leader, Nigel Farage, who's in Brussels for us now. Thank you for joining us. You're a long-standing EU critic, and Britain has said no to tighter controls, leaving Euro countries to sort themselves out, really. Surely the UK is now being pushed further aside.
Well, let's hope so, because we don't want to be part of a political union. We don't want to be part of an economic and monetary union. What David Cameron has done is to say, look, can we have some small concessions, please? President Sarkozy told him to take a running jump, and he's vetoed the treaty. So on the face of it, I should be cheering David Cameron and say, isn't this marvellous that a British Prime Minister has finally stood up and said something? But of course, the reality is that these 17 countries are determined to press on with this Euro project, mistaken though I believe that is, and it actually leaves Britain now in a really difficult position, because we're still members of the Union, we're still bound by all its legislation, and yet what's perfectly clear is that henceforth we will have no influence whatsoever. And actually what I'm getting in the hall today from journalists from all over Europe is that Britain is now despised. So I think what will happen now back in the United Kingdom is we're about to launch into a very big national debate about whether we should be members of this union at all.
But if these countries are going to push on, as you say, can the 17 euro-using nations solve this by themselves?
Well, listen, the word solve implies that there is some easy solution to hand. There isn't. The euro is a misconstruction. Countries like Greece and Portugal should never have joined it in the first place. And by increasing the size of bailout funds, by taking more power from democratic nation states to the centre, does nothing to address the fundamental problem that Greece and Germany cannot live together inside a single economic and monetary union.
Well, that's interesting. So if there's a separate financially based group within the EU, are you saying this could lead to a split in the union then?
I think what we saw in the early hours of this morning was the biggest split in the European Union in 50 years. You know, the United Kingdom has been a member of this thing since 1973. We're a big economy, we're an important country, and whether David Cameron knows it or not, what he did last night was the first step towards the exit door.
How easy will it be for those countries to convince their populations about facing tighter controls? We hear a lot about the politicians, but what will the people think of all this?
Believe you me, if we were to put this euro package to the electorates of Greece, of Portugal, of Ireland, of Italy, of Spain, they would all say no. Because, you know, the better solution is to have their own currencies back, to have a successful competitive devaluation, and then and only then to put in place the kind of austerity measures that are needed to get their borrowing back under any sort of control. And really, these countries now find themselves, these electorates find themselves, trapped inside an economic prison that is called the euro. Their democracy has been stripped from them, and my fear is that the kind of civil disobedience and civil disorder that you've already seen on the streets of Greece will multiply.
Now, the talks are not over yet, though. Markets are already jittery because they couldn't find the unified solution. If you were a betting man, what would your prediction be of how the next crucial 24 hours will actually pan out?
I think in the next 24 hours, the 17 politicians, not peoples, will agree that they are going to push on, that they are going to give incredible dictatorial powers to unelected bureaucrats based in Brussels. The markets will remain extremely nervous, and remember that even the package they're talking about today will take until March to implement, and I think in the meantime the Eurozone and particularly the Mediterranean countries are extremely vulnerable indeed, and I do not discount that a breakdown in the markets will overwhelm the whole euro problem, and that the Eurozone countries and the EU institutions will find themselves simply not big enough to cope with it.
Those Mediterranean countries you mentioned, if any of them should leave the euro, won't that cause terrible trouble in itself?
Well, listen, the argument always is that we must maintain the status quo, because if we don't, the sky will fall in and there will be disaster. Just look at what happened to Iceland. You know, Iceland came through this credit crunch in the most horrendous situation. Several of her banks went bust, her currency collapsed, interest rates soared, but 3 years on, the Icelandics have a growth projection next year of 3%, and things are going well. And what it says to me is that if you're stuck in a bad marriage, the best thing to do is to end the marriage and start again, and I see no hope at all for the Greek economy stuck inside this economic prison that is called the euro.
Okay, Nigel Farage, European MEP and leader of the UK Independence Party. Thank you for your views here on RT.
Thank you.
Well, that's an opinion, and I happen to share it. But I think what I'd like to do at this point is to just run you briefly through what has happened in the last few days. And by the last few days, of course, I don't include the weekend, because this crisis really blew up on Thursday night, Friday morning. So let me just explain the framework here. There is to be a brand new treaty among the 17 euro nations, that's to say the nations out of the European community which use the euro as their currency. So the treaty will be contained among those nations, and all the remaining European Union nations except Britain will join in the new treaty as well. Now, the problem, of course, with this is that the European Union contains really two brackets of members, those which are inside the Union and subscribe to the euro, which are 17 of them, and those which are inside the Union but don't subscribe to the euro, which in, i.e. that maintain their own currencies, and there are 10 of those, and 17 plus 10 makes 27. Now, basically, the 17 euro members think that they are in some sense superior. They've sort of signed on for more than the others, and therefore they have the right to make decisions which affect the others, but without necessarily consulting them, which of course is quite unacceptable to the 10 that are outside of the community of the euro. But it will, of course, take months before the details of this new agreement are ironed out, and it'll actually take years to implement it. But the officials are just sort of hoping that merely stating that it will restore confidence to the markets and convince investors that it's safe to buy toxic bonds from Italy and Spain will do the trick, that the confidence will come back, that people will buy the bonds and the markets, and that they can sort of paper over the cracks until they get this treaty fleshed out and ready to be voted on. But to give you some idea of what the treaty terms are about, for example, national budgets would have to be approved by Brussels, debt limits would be imposed on every nation, and sanctions would automatically be imposed on any country that exceeded the debt limits. So you're talking about an enormous invasion into the legislative domain of each of these countries. And Europeans in general haven't really had a problem with this. Britain has always been outside that kind of framework. Britain believes that it deserves to have sovereign rights over its own internal legislation. And indeed, Europe has impinged on that quite considerably. Some of the legislation that comes from Europe is really quite ridiculous. I won't go into it now, but you've probably heard examples of legislation which is so absurd that it doesn't bear scrutiny. But that's basically what you get when you join up with a membership of a club where, frankly, you don't really belong. But one of the comments made by German Chancellor Angela Merkel were as follows after the meeting. What we have achieved tonight is a tremendous step towards a stable Europe. This summit will go down in history. A little bit exaggerated in my opinion, but Europeans are of a mind to uniformalize themselves. They don't want the kind of conflicts that they've had in the past, so any amount of flowery language will do for them. I think it's exaggerated, but this is the way it is. And the French President Nicolas Sarkozy repeated that the summit would go down in history, and indeed it may do that, but it certainly won't solve any of Europe's problems. And I think that's where we get to in all this. All this talk and flowery gestures don't really do the trick for Europe. Europe's debt problems are there. They were there before it all began, and they will be there long after all this fanfare is over. It's actually much more amazing what this treaty doesn't do than what it does do. It doesn't promote any kind of economic growth in any way. It doesn't resolve the banking crisis going on in Greece, Italy, and Spain. It doesn't resolve the growing panic in European bonds. It doesn't resolve the problems raised by S&P when it warned of a possible downgrade of all the EU summit. Even if the agreement did mean something, it would still have to be approved by 26 nations. And there are obviously going to be massive delays. And indeed, some of the parliaments might reject the agreement, and some may have even to have a referendum that itself may reject it. So no one really believes that Friday's agreement is going to make any difference to the markets. In fact, it could be said that the agreement had an audience of just one person, Mario Draghi. You've only got to look at the markets today. The Dow Jones is down 150 points. The DAX German index is down 143 points. I mean, it wasn't a very difficult conclusion to come to after the frenzied purchase of the markets on Friday, that basically once people had had a chance to calm down and really study the lay of the land, that they were going to see that this whole thing was some kind of fantasy that made no real sense. And indeed, that's exactly what we had. Markets have fallen almost back to where they came from on Thursday night. And frankly, I think this is the beginning of a very, very turbulent and negative period for the markets over the next few months. You know, if Merkel and Sarkozy can convince Draghi that they mean business, he would arrange for the ECB to print money, but of course that's not going to happen. He said that he would not do that, Draghi being the Ben Bernanke of the European Central Bank, the president of the bank. He said that he was not prepared to make any such bond purchases. Of course, is a disaster for those people who believe that the only way that you can cure this kind of shortfall is to print money, which, of course, is the last thing you want to do. The famed throwing of the drug of choice at the addict, the drug being money, the addict being all these debtor countries that just feel that if only somebody would hurl a little more money at them, they could make do and turn around. I mean, it is as pathetic as that. The British Prime Minister David Cameron said, who not really noted for his extreme tact in these matters, and he said in front of the entire community on Thursday night, he said, I said before I came to Brussels that if I couldn't get adequate safeguards for Britain in a new European treaty, then I wouldn't agree to it. What is on offer isn't in Britain's interest, so I didn't agree to it. We're not in the euro, and I'm glad we're not in the euro. Perhaps not very tactful, certainly he irritated the French President Sarkozy enough that when it came time for handshaking, Sarkozy refused to shake his hand. But hey, I mean, the main point of the difference was that euro officials wanted to impose a financial transactions tax on all countries, but almost the entire tax would fall on London, which, of course, would provide a back doorway for Britain to contribute to eurozone bailouts, even though Britain is not in the eurozone. It seems a little bit unfair to me, but that's what was being promoted here. And, you know, there's been a lot of hostility between France and Britain over the European Union fiscal matters. It blew up in 2005 over agricultural subsidies for France, and it's sort of peaking again over the financial crisis. And Sarkozy got very upset recently that Cameron was, as he called it, meddling in Eurozone affairs, even though Britain is not a Eurozone nation. And they had some very angry words on Friday, apparently. It's kind of ironic that the Maastricht Treaty that formally launched the European project, signed by 12 leaders of the European community exactly 20 years ago, to the day, as a matter of fact, on December the 9th and 10th, 1991, European politicians are now harshly criticizing Cameron for not signing on to Friday's deal, saying that Britain is now completely isolated from the other European Union countries. And as I saw a rather amusing comment today, Britain is as isolated as passengers standing on the quayside of Southampton's docks were as they watched the Titanic sailing away. I few doubt that Cameron's decision represents a historic split in the European Union. Absolutely no question about that. So there you go, ladies and gentlemen. We have a caller on the line. Creighton from New York City wants to talk about the printing of the dollar. Good morning, Creighton. How are you today?
Hi. Can you hear me?
I can indeed.
Hello. Can you hear me, Richard?
Yes. Are you Creighton?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Yes. No. Please go ahead. We're loud and clear, so the mic is yours.
Well, I was wondering, why do people insist on inflation because of the overprinting of the dollar? Why do people continue saying that?
Oh, very simply, because like any commodity, the usual rule of thumb, Creighton, is that when there is an increased supply of a commodity, then the usually you have a situation where people buy more, the price goes down, people buy more, they have more currency to spend, and so the prices of things go up because there's a pressure, an upward pressure on the prices, as those who sell things realize they can get more money for them because there's more money to be spent because it's, you know, being printed. And so the price of those things goes up. Now,
but then how do we...
Yes?
But then how do we fall in... I know that you're always talking about deflation. Then if that's happening, then how do we fall into deflation? Because deflation would be a lack of supply of dollars.
Exactly. Right? Well, you see, the point is, and the point that I've always tried to make, is that the rule of thumb that I've just described doesn't apply in this instance for one reason, which is that there is much more money that is being sucked out of the system through, you know, defaults, through bankruptcies. You know, trillions of dollars have been lost in the housing market alone through falling prices and through, foreclosures. And defaults of one sort or another. This has the effect of sucking money out of the market. So the amount of money that may have been replaced by Ben Bernanke is trivial in contrast. So therefore, if there is a net diminution of money in the money supply, then you're going to see the deflation that I've been talking about. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, so we're actually having rising prices and deflation happening at the same time.
Yes. I mean, basically, deflation is not a function of price. Price is a function of deflation or inflation. But it doesn't
right.
work the other way around. If you have, for example, a rise in the price of oil because the Middle Eastern countries, I'm just giving you an example, I'm not saying that that's happening right now, but let's say that the OPEC countries, the Middle Eastern countries, reduce the availability of oil, then clearly the price is going to rise. Now, that's an isolated incident, and that is not inflationary. That is simply an instance of where price has been rising against the overwhelming majority of prices which may have been falling in an economy. For example, like today, copper is down 12 cents a pound as I speak. Soybeans are down 6 cents a bushel. Gold is down $55 an ounce. Silver is down $1.28 an ounce. Platinum down 32. These prices are forming, Creighton. This is not inflationary. And it's not deflationary either. It is simply an effect of deflation, which is what we've been talking about. And the effect is that prices are falling. And one thing I've always tried to emphasize, but is extremely hard to get across because the weight of the mainstream media always has it that when prices go up, that's inflationary, and when prices go down, that's deflationary. It's not the right way to look at things. And if you do look at things that way, you're likely to get hurt, especially if you're a trader. In recent weeks, for example, crude oil has been rising, and now it's falling again. So in order to really define the trend, you really do want to know whether we are in a deflationary or inflationary environment, because that is going to hold sway overall in the long run and cause the prices to go in the direction of the so-called deflation, whether it's deflation or inflation. Make sense?
So actually holding on to cash, as you always said, will hedge you against this deflationary environment, because you always hear people say, oh, buy gold, buy silver, because we're in an inflationary environment. You know, the cost of your cash is going down by 5% due to inflation. And you keep hearing that over and over again. I know you're saying the opposite. And every other financial show I hear, they're always saying, you know, buy dividend-paying stocks. And it's easy to want to get sucked into that direction. And because most people really do not say, other than say Nicole Foss, hold on to cash.
That's absolutely correct. Every word of what you say is totally correct. I'm glad that you really seized the essentials of all this, Creighton, because as you rightly say, it's extremely difficult to maintain a level head when everybody is telling you, you know, that prices are going to go up, that you have to get rid of your cash to buy something, whatever it may be, gold or, you know, any other kind of commodity.
Yeah, they say gold is money, you know. Gold is money. Hold on to gold because your dollars are going down. And you're really saying that the dollars are being sucked out of the system and you need to hold on to your liquid cash because it will be harder and harder to acquire and to maintain.
Correct. That's absolutely right. And gold is not money. Never, ever believe anybody who tells you that gold is money for any reason. It means they don't know what they're talking about. Gold used to be money. When money itself, i.e. the dollar, was tied to gold through a gold standard, then clearly gold was money. But you see, if gold is not tied to any kind of transactional currency, which is what I call money, then how can you call it money? How can you walk into, you know, a supermarket and buy your goods and hand out, you know, gold coins and expect them to take it with a straight face? I mean, isn't that what money is supposed to do? Isn't it supposed to be an instrument that prevents the need for barter, that offers a medium of exchange? Well, gold doesn't do that, and it won't do that until or unless it is fixed to some kind of money, and then at that point it becomes money again. So it seems to me that this is very obvious, and that people who claim that gold is money are kind of grasping for straws and looking for a reason to buy gold where there is none. That's the only explanation I have for otherwise level-headed people to you know, rant on about how gold is money. I see no way in which there is any kind of logical argument to be made that gold is money when gold is simply a free agent, as free as soybeans or pork bellies or sugar, you know, or anything else. It just isn't. It just isn't money. I'm sorry, but it has to be considered a commodity. It goes up and it goes down. And if you buy it and it goes up and you sell it, you make money. And congratulations. And if it goes up, or rather if you buy it and it goes down and you sell it, you've lost money. And then you have, you know, my heartfelt condolences. But one way or another, do not consider it as money. It is an absurd idea, and it will not help you to decide what you need to do.
Well, I know you talk about shorting the market as well, and over the past few years, wouldn't you, I know in your own positions, have gotten very hurt by that over the past, I mean, we've had such run-ups and downs.
Oh, yes. I happen to believe that the market is headed down in a disastrous and absolutely far-reaching manner over a very long period of time. And during the time when the market goes up and you are in a position of shorts when the market is going against you, that can hurt. Yes, absolutely it can. But I think what's important to understand is that you have to take a view, or you have to take positions, and over time, if you're right, you will make a lot of money. This is exactly what happened back in 2006 and 2007. I became bearish on the market after the rise, after the rally out of 2002. I became bearish in May of 2006, and it wasn't for another year until the market started to go down. But when the market finally went down, by the time we got to the end of 2008, we had made a lot of money out of this. But it you know, it requires patience. Investing is not a precise science. You know, you need to have a certain degree of understanding of what what opinion, what kind of a stance to take when things do go against you, in order to be clear in your mind that you are, in fact, correctly placed in a trend, in order to be able to make out profits at the end of it. But that's investing for you, Creighton.
So is that just a matter of timing? How do you, or do you, are you dealing with like exchange traded funds to slowly enter into the market your negative position?
No, I don't. I mean, this is another subject altogether, the business of investing, and I could do a whole show on this. I mean, there's no, this is not something that one can kind of slough off in a couple of comments. There are traditional ways of what they call dollar cost averaging investment, which means just buying a given amount of an investment every, say, 3 or 6 months, and over
right.
the long term you're supposed to make money doing it. It doesn't always work. It's not a panacea for investors who don't know what to do or anything like that. But there are certain ways in which people have discovered a way to place funds over time, and some of them work better than others. I guess that's the best one can say about that.
Maybe I'll call you off air to get some more information about that.
Understood.
Also, do you know, is there a website that, or a list of banks that you could suggest that if you're holding on to a large position of cash and you need to divide it into different bank accounts rather than, say, holding on to something like Bank of America or some of these other riskier banks, that you would point your listeners in a direction of
I've given websites out in the past. Marty Weiss put out a very interesting website of banks and the credibility of banks. I'm not sure if he still does. I haven't followed it for some time. Bankrate.com has an excellent site. I have, again, I don't know, I can't remember the name of the site, but you can Google Bankrate, all one word, Bankrate, BankRate.com, and you'll come up with a site which gives the current ratings of banks. Don't forget that you have your insurance with the FDIC to cover you. But that being said, obviously you don't want to tempt fate. You do want to try to find the best banks you can, preferably AAA rated. There are fewer and fewer of those, but a lot of people have asked me if credit unions would work. I think the credit unions are excellent. They have this chance of shenanigans in the credit union than there is with the Bank of America, for sure. I wouldn't touch Bank of America, for example. My wife and I used to have an account there before we left the States for Singapore 3 years ago, and we took all our money out of that and placed it in another bank. I'm pretty glad we did, too, because I personally think that Bank of America is going down, but that's just me.
Right.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for calling. I do have to take some time now for our promo break. So thank you again for calling, and good luck, and let me know if I can help. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's do it. Let's take a break, and I'll be right back. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. Got lots and lots of emails, so I think we're going to do those right now and see what time we have left at the end of those. As I always tell you, the emails are the most important things on my show, as far as I'm concerned. So let me see. Let me see what we've got. First of all, see if we've got anything off the... off the email here. I got a message from Susan Alexander, who talks about the... next meetup group, in which I had apparently mislabeled the 30th of January. It is in fact the 29th of January. That's the next meetup group for those of you who would like to discuss ways of handling the current crisis with a particular emphasis on leaving the country. That will be the meetup group in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And it will be in the George Street Ale House. which I shall give you more details about when the time comes. I would be grateful if you would call said Susan. She does need to know if you're going to be able to make the meeting that day. And so if you would be kind enough to call her, she would be, I think, very happy to hear from you. Her name is Susan, and her phone number is area code 202-246-5131. Once again, that's 202-246-5131. And if you wouldn't mind calling her, let her know whether you, if you want information, but more particularly if you would like to be in attendance, it will help her immensely. Very quickly, my own information. This is Richard Martin, the wake-up call, coming to you live from Singapore. And the call-in number, as our good friend Clayton discovered, is 888-874-4888. If you'd like to call in, I would be glad to talk to you. Once again, it's 888-874-4888. My email address, if you prefer to write in an email, you may, and the email address is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin. GFAWD is Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design, the company that I'm working with, .com. Once more, rm@gfawd.com. If I get an email in during the show, I will attempt to get to it right away. And finally, if you want to call me in private, you may do so, because I have a direct line within the United States, takes you straight to Singapore. An area code in Sarasota, Florida, 941-441-1682. Again, my direct line in Sarasota is 941-441-1682. All right, let's start off with Steve Kruger's little rant, two-liner here, and it goes as follows. Thanks, Richard, for the trip down memory lane when Woody Allen was genuinely funny in his early days. Merkel's solution solves nothing. It's almost unenforceable. The German shepherd watchdog has no teeth. This only delays the bad ending. Precisely. Thank you very much, Steve. That was absolutely, totally on the ball. A slightly longer one from Steve came in. None of these are in any particular order, chronological order, so we just take them as they come. Richard, this chart dulls the senses. When the world enters the terminal depression that lurks just down the road, I have to ask just who is going to pay off these bets and with what? As I understand it, only $50 trillion exist in the world as printed money or debt. The rest is fantasy money. Non-existent debt, money, digital entries that might as well be written on ice cubes. To collect all these bets, you'll have to be one of the first 20 in line. When the rush starts, they will hang up the out-to-lunch sign. At that point, it's all over. Richard, I see some radical thinkers are talking about a time in the future when the people of the world will not use money. Imagine that, buying stuff without money. Very utopian. Hold the phone, Richard. Isn't that what we have today? You go shopping and at the checkout, you hand the cashier plastic, not money. The store is happy, you're happy, what could be better? In fact, we Americans have been living in a utopian paradise since 1971, when Nixon freed us from the constraints of a money-based society by removing what little value that the dollar had. You can actually say Nixon made today's condition possible, and he did it without any recognition from the Nobel Committee. The government has stuck to it. So we, the dumbass people, only because we allow it. We spent many years acting like sheep, and now we're seeing the outcome. Lamb stew, not pretty. Steve Kruger. Absolutely right, Steve. I've always said it. August the 15th, 1971, was the day that changed the country for good. That was the game changer, and it was Nixon behind it, and things have never been the same since. I got a question from John Desmais, who says, hi, Richard, I have a question for you. How many national central banks are privately owned like the U.S. Federal Reserve? I didn't know the answer to that one, John, so I decided to look it up. And I spent, actually, a good 10 minutes Googling this in order to sound intelligent, and I find myself just as stupid as I was when I started. I think the reality is that it's very hard to find out. You see, the one thing that one can say about central banks, John, is that they are independent, at least notionally independent. The idea being that they don't respond to political pressure. And indeed in Singapore, the president himself has the ultimate call on whether funds are used or not out of the central bank, so as not to be subjected to pressure from governments to basically spend the wealth of a country like the United States does. It's exactly to avoid what has happened in the United States that the central banks do this. Now, who owns them? It's somewhat difficult to tell. The oldest bank, central bank in the world, is the Swedish Riksbanken, and that is the central bank of Sweden, and it's been around since the 16th century, and it is not owned by the state, but it is basically an offshoot of the government, an independent offshoot of the government, and receives its charter from the state, very much like the Fed receives its charter from Congress. And what people don't realize about the Fed, which is to a degree privately owned, because banks, in fact, are the makeup of the Fed, is that it could be disbanded at a stroke of the pen by Congress by tomorrow afternoon. They absolutely could decide to put an end to it. It is as simple as that. It is a congressional agreed institution. It was set up unconstitutionally, as it happens, by Congress, which was given by the Constitution unique power to create the money of the state. And it cravenly gave that right away to this Federal Reserve, and it could, as it has done twice in the past in the United States history, cancel the charter of the then ongoing central bank. It could do it again for a third time. In other countries, as far as I'm aware, what I could make out, John, is that they are not privately owned. But it's a murky issue, and I really think that most of them are chartered by the state as an entity of the state, but independent from the state. That's my understanding. Okay, Lewis wrote in. Lewis is on a world trip around. He is our ex-monitor of the meetup group that meets in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And he wrote in saying, Richard, this is an article that my Ferrari driving former roommate in Beirut wrote about the real estate investing in Beirut. He works 12 hours a day at his startup company and has two major projects in various states of development. What are your thoughts about this market, if you have any? Will Lebanon be affected by what's happening in Europe and the U.S.? I believe it will, but everyone I speak to here says it will not be. Regards, Lewis. Yes, every country on earth will be affected by the depression. It has to be, because Europe and the U.S. together are easily the world's most important power block, economic power block, and when they implode, as they are busily doing right now as we speak, the markets for other countries' products will simply not be available to the U.S. and Europe, because there won't be any money with which to buy them. And this is what's bring down the Asian markets and the South American markets vary considerably. But of course, as I've always said, because they are creditor countries, as was the US in the 1930s, they will be able to put themselves together again much more quickly than either the US or Europe. But yes, all countries that have any trade, anything to do with the US or Europe, such as Lebanon, Lewis, yes, they will be affected. It's absurd for anybody to say they will not be affected. Of course they will be affected. And then, depending on their individual issues, internal issues, they will recover either more quickly or more slowly than the average. But yes, I'm afraid to tell you, it will be affected. Beirut will be affected. Beirut real estate will be affected. And I'm sure, as you say, it is a fragile situation. And as far as the markets are concerned, I think the markets are going to fall precipitously over the next few months. I think it is clear that markets have been falsely identified, lights at the end of tunnels, and unfortunately those lights, if they exist, are trains coming the other way. Thank you for your email, Lewis, and let us now take Manny Ramos's email, written in bold caps. So he must have something important to say, and I shall tell you what it is. Hi, Richard. I am writing you because a friend of mine is telling me that I can become very rich if I buy lots of dinaris, which I believe is the Iraqi currency. Helen tells me that the Chinese are buying billions of dollars of dinari currency. What is your advice, Manny? Manny, I've got bad news for you. I have no advice whatsoever. I'm not familiar with the Iraqi currency. I didn't even know it was called a dinari till you kindly told me. I would be very cautious about buying the currency of a country which, apart from oil, has absolutely nothing to offer the world in terms of exports. You know, if in fact there is an increased demand for oil, the currency might do well. My feeling is that oil is headed very much lower, much more quickly than most people thought, because there's no peak oil. That's all just a figment of people's imagination. But don't tell anybody I said this, because it will not make me a popular pundit if you do. Stick with dollars. That's my advice. I think the dollar is going to go up, and I think that you'll do well if you hang on to United States dollars. Now, remember that this has nothing to do with how wonderful the U.S. economy is. It is simply a function of supply and demand. As I mentioned earlier, in terms of an earlier caller, the United States dollar is likely to decrease quite dramatically in supply. Yet that because it is the reserve currency of the world, it will contain a lot of people who need it and wish to buy it and have to buy it, if only to pay down debts. So that would be my advice to you, Manny. All right, David wrote in saying, hello, Richard. Heard you on various talk shows and find your take on various issues to be very informative and insightful. I'm getting married. Congratulations, David. And I'm looking to purchase a home within the next 6 months. Shame on you, David. Sorry, that's how it goes. I'm purely looking to protect my savings until I purchase my property, and I'm not concerned over making interest on this money or the rate of inflation. Just want my money to be safe short term. That's my only concern. Just in case there's a bank collapse or holiday or something else that's unforeseen, do I go with 1 to 3 month treasury bills with automatic rollover, or do I leave my money in my savings accounts, FDIC insured? Again, I don't care about making interest, just looking to protect my money short term. My fiancé is already invested in gold and silver and commodities, so we're fine as far as that's concerned. Thanks for your help. I've asked around, and I'm getting a runaround with no real answer to my concern. Thanks for your help, David. First duty of the day, David, get your girlfriend to sell your gold and silver. You're not, unfortunately, fine as far as that's concerned. I think you're not fine at all. I would definitely, definitely get out of those things. As far as the money itself is concerned, if you want it short term, remember to invest it short term. Now, you don't say where your money is invested in terms of your savings account, FDIC insured. If it's invested in long-term bonds, you probably want to sell them and buy short-term treasury bills, but just keep the money, you know, short-term. That's the most important thing. Now, the other thing is, I've got a bone to pick with you, David, about buying a home within the next 6 months. I don't like that idea. I don't know why you think you need to do this. This thing about having your own home, owning your own home, nobody owns their own home, and until the day that one United States state cancels the state tax on property, nobody in the United States will own their own home. They're renting it from the state. And so, but that's quite apart. That's a red herring here, David. You do not want to purchase. I do enough, you know, comments on the show here about real estate. I put out enough emails about real estate. You should know by now that if you're talking to me about real estate, you want to be aware that I will not recommend real estate, almost certainly for at least another 2 to 3 years, and maybe even a lot longer. Stay away from real estate. You can rent, you can get some really good deals depending on where you live, but buying real estate is a mug's game, and it will remain that for a long time to come. There is much too much inventory on the market. And I'm talking about invisible inventory, inventory that the banks own but have not yet placed on the market because they don't want to flood the market. It is impossible to say how much inventory there is out there. All I can tell you is that there is a lot of it. And people don't have money. First-time home buyers don't have the money to buy their first home because, A, they're not making any money, and, B, the price of homes is too high. And until they come down to a price where first-time home buyers start buying homes in earnest, allowing all the other people on the rungs of the ladder to step up for the next rung, you're not going to find prices going anywhere except down. That's my opinion, and I stick to it, David. All right, then we have another email from Norma Ramos, who says, "Dear Richard, I'm a long-time listener," lots of O's in that word, "long-time listener to the Gary Now Show. I admire and appreciate his work greatly. That is where I first started hearing you. I just downloaded some of your shows, and I'm really frightened by your very scary warnings and dire predictions. What is even scarier is that your analysis has proven to be right so far. You keep telling we Americans to get out. Where are 310 million Americans supposed to go? Seriously, isn't the solution to stay and fight for our Bill of Rights? Don't we have a responsibility to fight for our democracy and social justice rather than run away and just look after ourselves? What happened to collective struggle? Did you leave? Where did you go? How's that working for you? Norma." Yes, I left. Where did I go? Singapore, and it's working out wonderfully well. Thank you very much, Norma. That's taking care of me. I guess the question that I ask of anybody who brings up moral issues about leaving the country is, if you really close your eyes, sit back, relax, and think about it, who exactly are you said to be owing something to? Who? Who are you owing something to? Are you owing something to your government? Are you owing something to your family? Are you owing something to your community? Or really, are you simply spending your life spinning wheels, hoping things are going to get better, when the people who should be owing things to you, such as your government, after all, that's what government is supposed to do, it's supposed to work for its people, are patently working against your interests, Norma? That's my question. With, you see, I have always felt in life that people who want to be admired or respected must earn that respect. And goodness knows there have been plenty of times in the history of the United States when it has earned the respect of its people because of its lifestyle, because of the wonderful way in which it allowed people to create wealth. You cannot say that about the United States for the last 30 years. It has been a country which has not in any manner, shape or form deserved the respect of its people. And since we only live once, Norma, we don't get a second time round, I believe that it is up to you to make the determination that either you can make a good life for yourself within the United States or you can do a lot better elsewhere. And my contention is that unfortunately you're going to do a lot better elsewhere. And that's why I take the view that I do. And I'm always interested to discuss that with people, but I fear that there isn't much, you know, to be said about that. All right, well, let's take one final email from Hugh, who says, "Dear Richard, years ago, I watched Senate hearings where highly trained, experienced, and expensive hired counsel grilled low-level functionaries about White House travel expenses, ancient law firm billing records, and long-dried liquids on women's dresses. But listening to Thursday's Senate committee questioning of John Corzine, I was treated to a pop-gun firing squad of amateurs allowing a well-rehearsed slimeball evade every serious question presented. Back in the 90s, senators were shocked, capital letters, that Hillary Clinton lost money on a $50,000 investment, no doubt made under sleazy circumstances, but yesterday I was treated to, quote, hope springs eternal that we will figure out what happened and prevent it from happening again in the future, end of quote, and quote again. I sense the pain that this event will have on your life, Mr. Corzine, end of quote. I kid you not, so much for a $1 to $3 billion account transfer crime. The Corzine's so-called knowledge, he knew nothing about what was going on. He just passed along recommendations and collected a paycheck. With all the smart-assed finance professionals out there, you'd think he could have hired one who could have out-sleezed this guy, Hugh Pumps. Hugh, I couldn't agree with you more. And that is always the problem in Congress. They have people who don't know what they're talking about asking supreme experts in their field anodyne questions and getting back answers which basically are the laugh of the town. And that's exactly what happened. If they would only have bothered to find some people who knew how this whole question of finance works and talked to John Corzine and grilled him, they'd have got some extremely different types of answers back from Corzine, and life would have been much more pleasant to behold. But such is not how we live in the United States. We have to deal with incompetence asking questions of people who unfortunately run rings around them. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I'm sorry that the hour has gone so fast, but it has, and it's over. And this again is Richard Martin, and by the way, please stay tuned for Johnny Miller talking about the expat files. He's on right after me, and until Friday, I wish you a wonderful week. Take care. Bye.